Today's program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning. You're listening to In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Joe Campanelli, and today we have two guests. Super excited. We have our very first return guest, Mr. Ryan Looper from T. Edward Wines, a good friend of mine. Welcome back, Ryan.
Wow, I'm honored. Thanks, Joe. Appreciate it.
And also excited. One of the most exciting winemakers, for sure, in the United States right now, Steve Mathiasen from Mathiasen Winery, as well as a winemaker for multiple other wineries. I guess a viticulturalist for multiple other wineries in California. So, Steve, welcome on the show.
Thank you.
I'd be happy to tell everyone your story, but I'd love for you to kind of just go through what got you first into wine, and then how you got to having your own label after consulting and helping other people with their viticulture for years.
I mean, my entire life, we grew up with a box of wine in the fridge, and and that was often over ice next to in the backyard in the patio, and. You know, I mean, it just, you know, we brewed beer in college, but really it's you know, gardening and being with plants, and that's where the passion started and has always been through from a kid being on my cousin's farm in North Dakota, gardening in high school, gardening in college, brewing beer in college, gardening in San Francisco, and being into wine from, you know, having that first fake ID at Trader Joe's and, you know, and just kind of, you know, I remember reading the back labels and it would say, this goes with chicken. Perfect. I want to get this one, you know, and, you know, having an incredible afternoon on a blanket in the park, drinking a bottle of wine and reading Jack Kerouac, you know. And so, you know, wine is life. I mean, you can't, you know, it accompanies any occasion. It's just, you know, how can you imagine not being into wine?
And what was your first winemaking gig? When did you first realize that you wanted to do this as a career path?
I still kind of wonder whether I'm doing wine as a career path. I mean, my day job is taking care of vineyards for people, yeah, and consulting on vineyards. You know, I went to Davis and ended up getting an internship working for a consulting company while at school. When I showed up at Davis, told the advisor I wanted to learn how to farm, and he said, you're not going to learn that here. You have to go work on a farm. So, you know, I ended up taking an internship, but we ended up with a consulting company and sort of learned the trade. There's a trade of consulting in agriculture. There's, you know, most farmers tend to have someone who comes around and helps them with their bugs and their fertilizers, you know, their irrigation. And I was really interested in organic farming, and a lot of growers trying to become organic, they've been conventional, they need help as well. And so I sort of learned about, you know, the beneficial insects and things like that. And then the clients I was working for taught me about, you know, tractors and how to till the soil and all those sorts of things. And so that was really, that's been, you know, that was what I always wanted to do, and that's still what I love doing. And the Four Seasons Ag Consulting happened to consult on vineyards. And so that was perfect because I already loved wine. And, you know, but the thing about grapes is, and wine is, that they start in the vineyard, they end up in the bottle. So there's like a process, you know, it's a seamless process, but so if you're just growing the grapes or you're just making the wine, that's not really a complete, you know, process of flow. It's not, there's no gestalt there. And so after 10 or so years of consulting on grapes, it was, I just sort of felt like I need to take this to the second half of it. It was more just a sort of logical progression.
And when you started making your own wine, You found some vineyards that had grapes that weren't necessarily common in California, like Robola Jala, for instance, Semillon. What inspired you to use these kind of, you know, offbeat grapes?
Right. So, you know, all these amazing people that I've run across over the years, and one of them was George Vare. And he's just a really neat guy, a real mentor for me. He's been in the business since the early 70s. And he still carries his passion for wine that he's just amazing for someone who's been in the wine business for 40 years. So many people get jaded. And he just loves wine. He loves sort of young people that are into it. And he had discovered Robola Jala. He had started Luna Winery as a retirement project for himself back in the 90s. And in researching Pinot Grigio with John Consgard, their first winemaker, he was sort of tagging along as the sort of manager finance guy, and he discovered Robola Jala in Friuli on one of their trips, fell in love with it, and I was working for him on taking care of his vineyard, and he's like, hey, I have this budwood, I got it from the Grosvenor vineyard, and, you know, this stuff's called Robola Jala, we need to graft it in the vineyard. And, you know, you just, again, you know, my experience up to then was, well, when it first started with Four Seasons Ag Consulting, it was like Chenin Blanc, Grenache, all these like big, what at the time were jug varieties in the Central Valley. And then it was like, okay, now we've made it to the big time. It's Cabernet and Chardonnay and Sauvignon Blanc. And so, you know, so in California, especially at that time, you just didn't get a lot of, you know, other than like Kermit Lynch, you didn't get a whole lot of things, interesting things come over from Europe. And so I'd never heard of Robola Jala. I didn't know anything about that. But we grafted it and kind of grew it, and it's pretty challenging to grow, and so that was a bit of a struggle. And then he was making the wine with Abe Scherner. Skolium Project he's a good old friend of mine. That he was the winemaker for George then, and they ferment the stuff on its skins. It was like 2003. And so it was totally bizarre. And so we went to
and put it in a 500 milliliter bottle or something, right?
Yeah,
I've had a few of those bottles. I remember telling Abe years later when I found out that he was involved. I was like, "Oh, I've had the Vare wine." I thought that wine was really exciting, and he thought it was really adorable that I called it Vare. But I just assumed because it's so, you know, inspired and reminiscent of those wines from Friuli. I thought that was really a great effort. And turning to you, Ryan, when you see something like in your book, something like a skin macerated wine from the States, like the Salinia Pinot Gris that we have, or in the Mathiasen Robola Jala blend, like Friuli inspired blend from the Napa Valley of all places. what do you think? Are people receptive to these wines, or is it a mixed bag?
Yeah, it's a mixed bag, but I've had the people that I work with are very open-minded. I'm very lucky in that way. And I think the other side of California, where you have some varietals that aren't the typical Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, Cab, now Syrah also, I think going into that direction, you can find some other angles, some other beautiful expressions from California. And I think everyone's into that. I it's taken a little while. I mean, think about it. 2003, they're fermenting Robola on the skins. And now I think it's more people are seeing that there's some value in looking into other ways of making wine and other varietals from California. So I think there's, I know there's something there. People are responding very well.
And Steve, so you have on the label, I'm looking at the front label right now, it has Mathiasen and then Napa Valley white wine. It kind of reminds me a lot of like Eddie Kaber wine. And I don't know if you're familiar with Eddie Kaber up in Friuli, who made used to make a variety of white wines, single grape white wines, and then kind of threw it all up in the air and said, you know, instead of that, I'm just going to make one wine called Eddie Kaber Collio Bianco. And the idea for this is that it should express the Collio, which is a region in Friuli, but should express that, and making these kind of single grape wines is not as expressive because then it's more about the grape. Is that at all what you're going for?
That's wild. We were just talking about this, actually.
Yeah. you know, this is a blended sort of crafted, created wine. And you know, when I first originally we had a blended red, and I thought, I want, you know, and I had something in mind when I was doing that, and with the white again, I had something in mind, and that's why we called it white wine. The idea is, you know, it's a white wine, and it was it. And so what Eddie Caber had in mind is probably what I had in mind there. We had two wines, a white and a red. And that was the case for a few years, and then ended up having a Chardonnay just sort of fell into me because I planted a Chardonnay vineyard, and then I wanted to make wine out of it. And now the floodgates have kind of opened up, and I've got wine ADD, have to do like 12 single vineyard wines.
But Steve,
but
you got
the white is still that's the core. That is our sort of flagship, that white wine. And it's interesting. Etienne Monti came and visited a few months ago, and I poured that wine for him. I was really curious what he was going to say, and he said, you know, you've created a wine here that has never existed before. And he said, for me, that's inconceivable. You know, where I'm from, we don't create wine. You know, we reveal terroir, and it was a really interesting conversation. Sort of thinking about, I hadn't really thought of it in that way, but it's a completely different mindset to sort of craft a blended wine versus a single vineyard, and you know, you can't compare them. They're two different approaches.
We were talking earlier about the bottle of wine that kind of made you think about blending and what that can do in a white wine.
Enzo Pantoni at Miani really was really generous with his time, spent a day with us in the vineyards and with the wines, and that was before I started with our white, and that was a huge epiphany for me that you could blend whites. And so I had in my mind I love refreshing whites. I work outside, and so, you know, so if I drink a beer, it's going to be a pilsner. If it's a, you know, if I drink a wine, it needs to be a white with a lot of acid and not a whole lot of alcohol. It's just, you know, this is what I like. And so, you know, you make wine for yourself, I think it's too much work, you know. I can't imagine making wine that you don't like. It's just inconceivable to me. And so I knew I was going to make a high acid, lower alcohol white, but I felt like I had to give up richness and complexity, I guess, to do that. And then tasting Miani's Bianco, I realized that you can have your cake and eat it too, basically. And, you know, just blatantly. So think about like Chateau Neuf de Pop. I mean, they figured that out a long time ago, but for some reason I hadn't figured that out. And so until having the Biancos in Friuli. And so that, so, you know, came back and said, okay, I'm going to come up with my, you know, work with the ingredients that I have, which is, you know, have Sauvignon Blanc. I need Semillon to balance the acidity and the Sauvignon Blanc. The Ribolla, you know, provides a finish and provides layers and complexity. And then Tokaj Friulano is this really nice lift. And that's the blend.
Couldn't you accomplish the same thing, though, by perhaps moving to a cooler part of the state than the Napa Valley?
You know, Napa... The Napa Valley has this amazing. It's sort of like just right. It's just warm enough. It's just cool enough. And you know, we're in the southern part of the Napa Valley, so it's from where I live and where our vineyards are to Calistoga could be in the summer could be a 15 degree difference. You know, regularly, so you know it could be 80 where we are and 95 in Calistoga. So where I am down in the Oak Knoll area, if you look at the degree days, is probably pretty similar to, you know, sort of maybe the warmer part of the Russian River Valley. Mm-hmm. It's a different because we get a little warmer during the day, a little cooler at night. But you know, it's the richness. I love cool climate wines. That's not what I don't want this wine to be a quote unquote cool climate wine because it's not only about sort of bracing, cleansing, minerality. There is a richness there that requires sun, and so and the blend accentuates that sort of dichotomy between richness and freshness. But even if as a single wine, like our Chardonnay from Linda Vista is also Napa Valley, it's actually that wine's brighter than our Sonoma Coast Chardonnay, partly because that's soil. Sonoma Coast is rocky, rocky soil, so you get a higher level of ripeness. But you still have, even though Chardonnay is very bright, there's a nice ripe Bartlett pear and a little bit of I don't know, call it golden weight that I think a Chardonnay really and it really needs. That's part of the pleasure of Chardonnay.
Ryan, when you're bringing someone one of Steve Chardonnays, for instance, who you know mostly deals with the not as balanced, or just the Chardonnays are a little bit riper and maybe have a little bit more oak. Do you try to not bring his wines to those people, or do you try to bring them and then say this is still Chardonnay, but it's a different kind of thing? What goes through your thought process when bringing out Steve's wines?
What you just said is dead on. I try and challenge just enough. If the moment is right, I show up and I bring something that challenges the idea. And what I would say is, it's a wine that's not trying to escape the terroir of Napa or wherever it's from, Sonoma, but it has a little bit more acidity. I think Steve makes very food friendly, drinkable wines. And that's what I love. I mean, if we go there, most everybody kind of comes together. If you go, like, do you like oak? If I'm just talking about vinification, then I'm probably doing it the wrong way.
Yeah. Exactly. So, Steve, you were named one of San Francisco Chronicle's Winemakers of the Year, Food and Wine Magazine Winemaker of the Year. Have you noticed that you're able to sell more wine or have new opportunities? Or how has that changed your business model?
It's really helped. I mean, again, we think about that skin fermenting Ribolla Gialla in 2003. You know, it's that there was no market for that then, right? And so it's there's been a whole long, like on the one hand is Food and Wine Magazine Winemaker of the Year, which is so helpful. I am so thankful for that. But it's not like getting 100 points with Robert Parker, you know? And so it's been a haul trying, you know, California is so stigmatized in sort of the world of really, wine cognoscenti, I guess, as I would put it. And for good reason, but it's a slow process, and it's really requiring and helping. It's helping to get the support of, and a lot of it's the young up and coming sommeliers that are willing to give California a chance again, and not automatically go to Europe for balanced wines. You know, we can't make balanced wines in California if we aren't supported in the marketplace in our efforts to make balanced wines. And it was a struggle with a Napa Valley wine getting, you know, the Napa Psalms saying, well, that doesn't taste like Napa, I don't want it. more adventuresome or, you know, classic Psalms saying, I don't really want a Napa wine, or I'm not really interested. And is that even possible to make a balanced wine in Napa Valley? So now having things like Food and Wine get behind it, and having this whole new generation of Psalms who are just incredibly open-minded and really about education. The sommelier culture is evolving so fast, and it's like this whole burgeoning, exciting thing going on right now in sommelier culture. And all of that is just, for me, is just incredible. I mean, now I feel like there's this community out there that wants me to keep making wine and make more wine, and that's definitely a new thing, and it's great.
Okay, I'm going to ask you both something to think about during our break. What do you think that the future is, the next few years for these kind of wines in California? Think about this during the break, and we'll be right back with In the Drink.
You're listening to Onion's Milk by Iggy Dean on heritageradionetwork.org.
Mm-hmm.
This is Chris Howell from Cain Vineyard and Winery. Thank you for listening to the show. In our industrial world of highly processed food and wine, we support the values of Heritage Radio Network. All of us at Cain encourage you to seek out individuality and beauty in everything you eat and drink. For more information, visit cain5.com.
And we're back on In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm here with, just a little reminder, with Ryan Looper, a good friend of mine from T. Edward Wines, who happens to represent the Mathiasen Winery. And also here is Steve Mathiasen, the owner and viticulturalist and winemaker at Mathiasen Winery, and winemaker of the year for multiple publications. But we were talking a little bit about the current state of wine in California and where it's going in the future. And I'd love to hear your thoughts about what do you think's happening the next few years.
It two or three years ago, I felt like I not only knew pretty much all of the what we'd consider exciting new winemakers in Napa, but knew that not of them, but knew them personally. Now I have no idea. There is so much going on that you know, it's way beyond being able to keep track of it. There's so many good new wines coming out of California. Just getting started, it's crazy. It's the tip of the iceberg. It's really exciting time for California and people, and it's great because it's the spirit of California. California is this place that you go to and there are less rules, right? And so you have some people that are passionate about Riesling, or they're passionate about the Jura, or they're passionate about whatever, but then they're going to try to do it in California and do it their own way. Yeah, there's tons of stuff. I think that we're going to see California being very, very relevant and exciting, region for wine discovery, which is what it should be.
Yeah, when we opened up Del Anima, I never in a million years would have thought I'd have a California wine on any of our lists. This was 6 years ago, and it never crossed my mind that would happen, that there would ever be wines in California that were that exciting to me. Now we have one of our restaurant lists is half American wines, and the majority of them are Californian. I originally was going to do 2/3 Italian and 1/3 American, and then it grew to half, and now it may be a little bit more than half. And I think just this dynamism, all of these creative people getting together and changing it around is probably what draws me to it so much. And then also the surprise. I really like how wine can be a surprise and a discovery for people. Yeah. One of the first things that we did on our first list was we opened up an Italian restaurant with no Prosecco or Pinot Grigio. And my idea that was there was there are people who are going to ask for these wines often, and I wanted to show them other wines that fit their same kind of flavor profile, but was maybe a different grape or a different region or something new. So I never thought California could give you that same sort of sense of discovery and new experience. And I feel like Ryan, you've introduced me to a bunch of new California wines, like that, the Pet Nat.
Right.
How cool is that wine?
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, I there's so much exciting stuff in California that people don't know about. There are old plantings of Napa Gamay. There'll be Gamay Noir coming out. There'll be old school white Zinfandel coming out, like Draper style. Like, there's just a lot. There's a return to the past and there's a new. And I really love the dynamic of that coming from California, because I think we're at the tip of the iceberg. Just to return to what we were talking about mm-hmm. earlier, there are some people that are a little hesitant because it's been such an old world focused market in New York. And I think as it comes around, it's going to be really an amazing time for California wine.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think sommeliers in New York pride themselves on knowing that the old world regions, mm-hmm. especially you see Burgundy and Riesling, the various Riesling, Germany and Austria and Piedmont. And, Those are the places that like New York sommeliers get super excited about. But you know, as we're going towards the idea of using domestic products and local products, I think that people do want to get behind a wine that's made here in the United States. Not that it's maybe any more local, because it is, you know, on the other side of the country, but it feels like, you know, I think I'd like to support something that comes from the U.S. That feels good, but only as long as it's something that fits in the ethos of the restaurant and the rest of your wine list. And I think it's definitely getting there. I mean, what do you feel? So you found that working closely with the sommelier community has been probably the most beneficial thing.
Yeah. The sommeliers, I mean, those wineries have different, I guess, ways of getting out there into the world. And you know, I mean, our wines are for food, and sommeliers have been, you know, that's a huge focus for us. I'm writing a column for the Guild of Sommeliers on viticultural practices, and just any opportunity I have to interact, I think, you know. And so a lot of my winemaking, you know, over the years, you go work the market and tasting with sommeliers in restaurants. I mean, the feedback I get has fed into my own development as a winemaker. I mean, it's a two-way street. You know, I don't have the opportunity to taste wines the way an average sommelier does. You know, every day they're tasting wines from all over the world, and so it's, you know, the education is both ways.
What's exciting, I'm just realizing as you're talking about, we have in this shipping container in Bushwick right now, we have the person who made the wine, the distributor, and then the person who serves the wine to the guest. So it's kind of the whole chain.
Oh, wow.
Or at least, you know, not the whole chain, but three parts of the chain. that's really exciting. So I mean, I'd love to taste the wine that you brought. What are we tasting here?
Okay, this 2010 white wine. So it's been in bottle for about almost 2 years now. So it should be just coming around, filling out. Should I go through it?
Go through it, please.
Okay, so it's a very sparkling straw wine. You know, I think that there's, you know, on the nose you have Meyer lemon, some honeysuckle, some fig. I don't know if you know what you get, but it's
definitely that lemon oil. There's lemon, but a more complex lemon. It's not just like straight lemon juice, but yeah, maybe like Meyer lemon
zest.
I'm super excited to that you started going into the whole Guild of Somme like tasting note with looking at the color and the nose. I was not expecting you to do that. I thought you were gonna say that 2010 was a warm year with even conditions. Oh, yeah. Or something like that, but that's really exciting. I mean, I could see working a whole day in the vineyard and then wanting to drink this at night. It's just
totally,
my mouth is watering. It's super refreshing and very, very delicious. And I like how it is refreshing but still complex, which is also something that sometimes you can have. Just like if you have like one of those really simple beers, that's nice in a dumb nice kind of way. It's like, oh, just a relaxation. But this, there's, if you want to pay more attention to it, there's quite a bit going on.
I think you're dead on with the description before. There's some richness and the high acid. You have two dimensions that are going on at once, which I like in this wine a lot.
Mm-hmm. And I like that the richness does put you in California, and yeah. I want the wine to be from California. I just want it to be balanced, and yeah. So I think that you really do accomplish that with this one. Can you tell me a little bit about the label? It's really curious to me.
So those are pruning shears. It's a whole montage of pruning shears, and it's pruning. You know, that's a tool that we use. It's the, you know, I'm trying to celebrate the craft that's involved in tending vines, and you know, the whole process of winemaking is a craft. And you know, tools are important. You know, they're in that sort of montage. It's sort of organic, but you know, it's organic on the one sense, but on the other sense, there's, you know, the underlying structure of it is that it's a tool. And so a good friend, Michael McDermott, is the label designer, and I think we were like his third label that he did, and he's gone on to do a ton of really great labels. He's an incredible artist. And so when he sort of wasn't a label designer yet, he was just getting started, and he was more of an artist when we originally did our label, and that was something that was really important to us, was that the label is a work of art. You know, it's not some focus group saying, well, this will stand out on a thing. This is, you know,
you don't have a marketing department.
No marketing department. It's art, and we want to
It's beautiful, and it's just as you're talking about this, and I'm noticing, you know, the label with the pruning shears, I'm just thinking about how the, maybe not the new superstar, but the new person who's getting the recognition is now the viticulturalist, maybe, instead of the winemaker, and that's, I think, a marked change as opposed to maybe 10 years ago when... Right. Yeah, or if even more recently. So we're winemakers, and you know, even winemakers who travel around the world are the ones who are getting a lot of notoriety. And I think that goes in line with the kind of wines that people like to drink. That was just an observation. But something else that I've been thinking about is for many years you've been and you still do grow grapes for other wineries. What from that time did you say, oh, wow, I've learned that, and I want to do that with my own winery when I'm making my own wine? And what were things that kind of shocked and horrified, and you're like, oh, I'm totally not doing that to my grapes?
To the grapes, interesting. Because there's so many things I've picked up along the way. I mean, in the vineyard, is this, you know, you learn from every piece of land, you learn something, you know, it's just experience. Farming is experience. There's, you know, you need to build up a body of experience, and then you try things again next year. Working with these winemakers with different vineyards, when I talk about the craft, I mean, like, any craft is, whether you're a plumber or a potter or a chef or a winemaker, is you building up a whole lot of sort of just little skills on how to do various little mundane things. And if you have, you know, eventually you assemble enough, this hopefully vast body of really mundane little skills, and then you can use them, make decisions and make things happen. So, you know, like, how do you prep a filter? How do you get rid of the flavor of a filter pad? How do you actually do that? I mean, there's no book, there's no instruction manual. You know, you have to stand there next to winemakers who are doing it and watch them and learn and try to figure out how to do it. So the more cellars you can be in, you know, my advantage is I've been a fly as the vineyard guy. I've been a fly on the wall in tons of wine cellars, and so you see how they do things, and go to the next cellar and see how they do things, and that's how, and you know, I'm self-taught winemaker, but I can't even count the number of cellars that I've spent time in, and just chatting with the winemaker and we're talking about the fruit and how it worked out, but by the way, here's how we're I decided it wasn't working for me, so I did punch down 3 times per day, I tried to swirl the punch down device at the bottom to swirl up the lees back in a suspension without crunching the seeds down there, you know. And you know, there are so many little things to a punch down, so those are the type of things I've picked up, all just these little things, and then equally what not to do. Is you look at the vineyard, you see the grapes, you work with the grapes, maybe you see the how the wine is made, and then you taste the wine, and you can see, okay, they did X, and boy, I don't like that wine, and so So I'm not going to do that. And
we were talking earlier about STEM inclusion with the Cab Franc and how the typical some of the people you work in the vineyards for would looked at you like you were crazy.
Oh yeah, the idea of putting stems in a Cab Franc because you feel the fruit is not green enough. It was pretty crazy, but for my peers, you know. But seeing what the effect of stems are on wine, it's like, okay, in this particular case, in that particular year of that particular wine, I wanted that because I was afraid that the Cab Franc we got a heat spell and we'd lost some of that green character that I really wanted in that Cab Franc.
Wow. Well, I think it takes crazy people to make changes happen and to create beautiful products such as your wine. Well, you're definitely going to be able to find these wines at La Picho. That's for sure. And Steve, thank you so much, Ryan Looper.
Thank you very
much. You're the man. Hopefully, you'll be our first 3-time guest.
I really hope so. Thank you.
And thanks to all for listening. This was In the Drink on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.